This is Nullius in Verba, a podcast about science.
What it is, and what it could be.
It's co-hosted by me, Smriti Mehta from UC Berkeley.
And me, Daniel Lagens from Eindhoven University of Technology.
In this episode, we continue discussing Dubin's eight-step method for theory building. We talk about the measurement of theoretical constructs, using logical propositions to make falsifiable predictions from theories, the importance of specifying boundary conditions, such as constraints on generalizability, and whether it can be done meaningfully before data collection. Enjoy.
Then, where do we go to?
Laws of interaction.
So now we're describing, we have the concepts in our model, and now we have to describe how they are related.
Yeah.
And do you feel people do a very good job describing these relationships between different things in their model?
You know,
I'm trying really to do this, not directional question asking, but I think I've
just... Yeah, you just did. But I recently been sort of learning structural equation modeling. And I think in that world, people probably do. I mean, you kind of have to. You have to explicitly state, you know, what the variables are, how they relate to each other. Are they correlated? Are they not correlated? Are your residuals correlated? Right? How, where are the paths? Or does, you know, does a path exist for everything? Or if not, right? I mean, I actually don't know enough to know if people do it well, but you are supposed to do it in that world. So maybe in some pockets of our discipline, this is taught and explicitly done, but definitely not broadly known. Yeah,
especially not explicitly, right?
Yeah.
People might mention a couple of things that are part of a theory, but then how and what? Yeah. Another thing I thought of, recent development that makes this maybe a bit more prominent, is the whole causal inference revolution.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, DAGs, I mean, that's all that is, right?
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Which I keep saying, which I always want to call them directed, I want to call them directed acrylic graphs, but they're not. They're directed acyclical graphs. It's such a terrible term,
It's a terrible term.
I can never remember it. I'm always like, what the hell? But yeah, DAGs, we'll just call them DAGs. Yeah.
And we just call them boxes and arrow books or something, you know? I mean, that's what it is. Like, it's just figures like boxes and arrows. Let's just be honest, people. Yeah. You don't have to come up with fancy terms. Yeah, it's just boxes and arrows.
Right.
But yeah, okay. Yeah. Directed to cyclic graphs, yes.
Yeah.
But I feel, I mean, I'm not sure how much, you know, with all these new things, it's not new for other fields, but it's definitely new for most psychologists. With these new things, people always jump on it and want to learn a ton about it. I wonder if it's being translated into research practice. It would be nice. I haven't seen it that much, but it would be nice if we see more of these.
I do think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Path analysis. Yeah. Stated. Sort of. Yeah. Connections between variables. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I have done this since a year or two or three. I do this at the master level. For my, I teach a course in advanced cognition. And I ask students to come up with a sort of analysis of a real world problem that they care about. So this is an assignment where they have to pretend that they're part of a behavioral insight unit, so sort of like a research unit for the government, and then there's a problem that they care about. And then I ask them to build a model of all the things that are relevant, because they are not really, you know, immediately testing some intervention or something. I first ask them, describe all the factors that influence this thing that you care about, and how these relate to each other, and what are moderators, and what are boundary conditions. Yeah. And so there's a nice text. It's a book by Jacquard and Jacobi from 2010. Yeah. It's called Theory Construction and Model Building Skills, a Practical Guide for Social Sciences.
Nice.
And it's actually quite nice for this component, really, like this modeling thing. Can recommend as a text for students. And they surprisingly love this assignment.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. I make them do it at the beginning of the course, and then they work on it, you know, and they do other stuff and they do other things related to their topic of interest. And then at the end, I also ask them to reflect on the model and update it. And I don't know, they are very positive about it. They like modeling. They like thinking very carefully about all this stuff. And I also think it happens nowhere else in the curriculum. Mm. So it's, yeah.
I'm sure
so
it's
they
useful.
Like it. So I can recommend people to build something like this in.
Very nice. Yeah. It's a good, that's a good resource. And I'm sure, like, I mean, you know, you have ideas. They might not be fully formed, but you probably have ideas about how things relate. So it's probably just helpful to have it for, to be forced to lay it all out on paper.
Clears
up your own thinking.
And especially if you do it before you really go into thinking, okay, so what are the things I want to measure? Because you come up with all these factors, you're like, oh yeah, this plays a role. Maybe I should also then ask people about, you know, how much money they have, because what I predict is actually that this is only a problem with people who are low on whatever, you know? I mean, so it will also guide you in which variables am I going to measure actually when I do a test.
Exactly.
So,
And it is, I mean, it makes your theory falsifiable, right? Mm-hmm. Once you have actually mapped it out, then you can test it explicitly to see if it's false. Otherwise, right, if you don't know how things are related and you just measure things, then you just can go running around, you know, correlating everything and running all kinds of regressions. But once you've actually set it up as a system where things have to be related to each other in a certain way, that's testable, right?
This is an excellent observation. Yeah. And in Dubin's book, he also explicitly says you have to specify negative laws. So where is there an absence of an effect?
Yeah.
And we often don't do this explicitly, of course, but he says, the absence of an effect.
Yeah.
This is part of what you have to build into your model, because that's where you can indeed falsify it. So. Mm-hmm. It's also clear, by the way, that also Dubin has really a strong hypothetical, deductive, Popperian kind of approach.
Yeah.
He's really, he says this as well, like, this is really my approach here. Mm-hmm. So I think this will appeal to many psychologists, but not all. So it's just so people know that this is the perspective he's taking. But yeah,
those people are not listening to this podcast.
You think so?
Well, yeah.
Oh, who knows? Who knows? Yeah. No, you might be right. Anyway, I mean, we have our preferences, it's true. But I mean, but it's interesting specifying what's not there. So you specify what is related, but also what not. Okay, good. Check. Interactions and relationship between variables, we have those. What is the next step?
Boundaries.
Oh, and this is also such a nice thing to do.
Yeah, establishing boundaries. What are the limits, real world limits of the theory?
So you have to think in advance, where would this apply, where wouldn't this apply?
Right.
And this is also something that is in the work of McGuire. We might have mentioned this before. He has this approach he calls perspectivism. And basically somewhere he says something like, all hypotheses are both true and false, which sounds very zen and very, you know, fake. And it's also in a paper that's very zen-y and zen seven koans of psychology or something.
Yes, okay.
But what he means is literally this. Oh, they are true.
It depends,
if he would just have said it depends. But these were the 70s, Schmidt. You had to be a bit, you know. Anyway, you're completely right. So he's basically saying it depends.
Right.
It's true under some conditions and it's not true under other conditions. but then think about this explicitly in advance. And I think that is actually really a nice kind of thing to do. So when you're thinking about your theory, you're saying, okay, so we predict this and this. And then you say, but when is that not happening? When is that, you know, what are the boundaries of this prediction? When would you not predict this? And people very easily will come up with stuff, you know, like, well, okay, of course not for people in this group or not for people with this personality or.
So in our discipline, I often see this done after the first test of the hypothesis, right? Mm-hmm. You often see papers where they'll first say, oh, we think X affects Y. And then they'll run some study, you know, MTurk study, and then they'll show the results. And then like the next three studies are about, oh, but now we're going to test some boundary conditions of what doesn't work under this condition versus that. Do you think there's some, like, do you think that's equally valid to do it that way? Or do you think it is, it would be a lot, like, how would it be different to having done this thinking before collecting any data in the process of, like, conceptual development? Yeah.
It's a very good question. And when I was reading this, I had exactly the same thought.
Yeah.
So it's very clear in the book that you're supposed to come up with this in advance.
Yeah.
But then I thought, how often does this happen? And how often can we actually do this? Like, it feels like impossible. And what you see, if people have to come up with this, and an interesting case where they would bring this up nowadays is, for example, if they explicitly have a section that is constraints on generalizability. So this is a suggestion by Simons and colleagues 2017, where you always have in your discussion section a constraints on generalizability. The idea is that this helps you to sort of defend against failed replications.
Right.
Because if you say this should happen all the time everywhere, well, then a replication of your study should show the same thing.
Hmm.
But if you say, I think this only happens in our country.
Right.
And I don't want to generalize based on the data I have to other countries, then you'd have to let the replication study be done in the same country, at least. And if they do it somewhere else. So this is really to help with working out, is a moderator really falsifying my theory? Or did I already say, like, yeah, but I didn't expect it would to generalize work to those contexts.
Yeah.
But then if you read them, so it's a nice idea, but if you read them, what do people say? Well, there are probably some parts in the world where you wouldn't find this effect. There's probably cultural moderators. You're like, yeah, yeah, sure, whatever, you know. I mean, but they don't come up with anything cool, sensible, so smart.
Specific.
It's just like...
Yeah, just vague.
Yeah,
yeah.
Just fake. Mm. And... It reminds me a bit of, you know, one of these big papers on generalizability is the weird problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they say, yeah, because things don't generalize, because we only study Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic people.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, yeah, that's just a list of things, you know, that's just a list of five things, but that's not a theoretical prediction for a boundary condition. Mm-hmm. You're just saying, yeah, who knows, maybe some of these five things limit how far this generalizes. Yeah, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. And I think we've seen more criticism that this is actually quite an atheoretical list, so that we have to come up with actual theories that predict these boundary conditions.
Yeah.
But where are these theories?
I don't know.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So ideally, we come up with them in advance.
Yeah.
But I think in practice, it's like you describe.
Yeah.
We do some research and we discover them, maybe.
Yeah. They're outside the boundaries of current work.
It does mean that we would have to do more work to figure out where boundaries are. We would have to have more specific studies where we explore boundary conditions. If we admit we can't predict them in advance, then we need more types of studies where we systematically explore the boundary conditions, right?
Yeah.
And that's also something you don't really see. You don't really see people say, so I have this one finding, but now I'm going to systematically do it across 12 steps. I'm going to do it further away from where I was or closer to where I was, or I'm going to do it more slowly, or I'm going to make people do it more quickly, or I'm going to do it when they're more distracted or less distracted or whatever things, you know, whichever dimensions are relevant for your study. And there's a term for this. It's called parameter range exploration.
Huh. Interesting.
So you have a certain parameter.
Yeah.
Let's say, you know, in your study, you decided like, okay, so people were a little bit tired, but not too tired.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, okay, but does that really matter? And how far does it generalize? Because sure, if people have fallen asleep, then you can't test them. And apparently you think it doesn't work if they're perfectly highly active. Okay, but how, you know, and then you have a range and you're like, okay, let's do it. And let's explore this range. And then we see, indeed, it stops working when they get pretty tired and it's stops working when they are, you know, drank four cups of coffee or, again, whatever parameter it is in your model. It could be something else than attention level. But so that I feel is something we don't do, and it would be worthwhile doing this more.
Yeah, I agree. I think a good example is the Milgram experiment. I think there was a lot of tests done on the Milgram experiment to test the boundary conditions. Like, well, how far away does it work if the person is in the same room versus not? Like, if the experimenter is wearing a lab coat versus not, or if they're in the same room versus not, right? So I think that one got tested, like, the heck out of it in terms of boundary conditions.
It's a great example. It's a great example because it's also one of the few things in my intro psych course where I feel you can really say this is the main effect, but actually it becomes much smaller if this happens, if the person is in a different room, if the person is this. And you're, exactly. It's a great example of where quite a number of boundary conditions have been identified.
Yeah. I mean, that is an example where some of the boundary conditions, it's fairly obvious that they should have been looked at as a parameter and could have been identified as important parameters a priori, right, before you actually did the study. I'm not sure that's the case for a lot of the stuff we do, but I think, do think, so I think it might be tricky to know which parameters would be important for a lot of the work. In this case, I think it might have been more obvious that, oh yeah, is the person sitting right next to you versus in a different room? Like that might be a boundary condition, right, to where it wouldn't work if you actually had to, like, you know, jab them with a taser or something.
But no, I agree. Right. I agree. Yeah. But this point, so these boundary conditions, I feel they're super important. They're super important actually for two things that I think will be big themes in psychology. One, of course, we mentioned generalizability, of course. I mean, we just have to do something about this. We have to figure out how generalizable are our claims and people are thinking about it. The second is actually another problem of heterogeneity. So we often have effects. We do studies in slightly different ways. And we are sort of confronted now. Are these actually all sort of the same effect size, more or less? Or are they really very different? Because if you change a setup a little bit, is that really a boundary condition in the sense of now we really are talking about a slightly different effect? This change really matters or not? And there might be small changes, but there are a lot of them. We do studies in many different ways. So I think for both of these kind of big questions that we'll face, a solid understanding of boundary conditions of our effects are going to be so important in the future.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good point.
The journal, Journal of Boundary Conditions. We need it. We need it.
Okay, so boundary conditions, very important and probably worth thinking very carefully about before you go about running your studies. Now, this one is, again, like I mentioned earlier, the fourth one is kind of interesting one to think about because I'm not sure I fully understand how it's separate from boundaries, but this is system states, a condition under which the theory is operative.
So then Dubin comes to this fourth category of system states, and I have to say it is maybe the vaguest of all of them. As I read the original chapter on this, I thought it's also interesting because as he was reading this, he was very influenced by the work by Nagel on something, because this is basically the only reference in this entire section. So it feels a little bit like he was just reading this thing. He came up with this idea of system states. He put it in the book. And you're sort of like, but maybe you should have spent like another 3 years thinking about this because you're not explaining it very well. Sorry, Dubin. But he means, I think he just means the larger system that you're operating in. So let's say as meta scientists, we would say scientists operate in a certain reward system. And this reward system is the system state. It has a certain state. But if the system changes, so we stop rewarding people for something else, then we would not predict these kind of theories anymore, right? Or we don't make the same predictions anymore. So our predictions are predictions. This is how people work. But when we actually, when we want to test them, they operate within a larger system state. Now, you could say maybe this is just a more extensive theory, right? So higher level kind of processes that play a role. What is this process embedded in? What larger system? But that's also, a cultural system, for example. They can change over time. But that's the kind of stuff he's describing. So you can't just stop at, maybe at the psychological level. Maybe he's basically saying, yeah, you also have to sometimes describe the more sociological aspects of this. Or when you study cognition, you have to also think, yeah, but what do these people operate in terms of social interaction between, right?
Yeah.
I think that's what he means with this system.
Yeah. I'm not sure what he means. But one example that came to my mind, which I'm not sure if it's correct or not, is like, say you had a theory about how people behave when they're being observed by others, right? Like sort of social facilitation theory. Well, that theory would only be operative if you're not alone.
Yeah.
Right? But I'm not sure if that counts as a system state issue or a boundary condition issue.
I agree. So it feels like it's sort of in the family of these things. But I think the boundary... The boundaries are basically part of parameters in your model, I guess. And these are a little bit more...
Higher order, sort of like, oh, when would you even use this model? Right.
Exactly. So what you describe is exactly what he means. Like, okay, so there's a system. And if you're by yourself, then yeah, this process stops
this
working.
This theory isn't even operative. Right. Okay, good. Yeah. I wasn't totally lost then, I guess. Good.
Yeah.
All right. So now we are done with the conceptual work.
Anything else you want to say? Now it gets exciting. Now we get to our propositions and our statements, and we can go ahead and test them finally.
Finally. After all that work. Yeah. So the next number five, that's step five in part two, propositions, which are truth statements about the theory.
So these are really formal statements. If this happens, then this is supposed to happen, right? So propositions. And one thing that's important to note here is that propositions are logical statements. He is talking about a little bit of formal logic that you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
And now we already talked about how people don't like to make conceptual definitions. People, you know, in our field typically get bored by this.
Yeah.
But when you go and talk about logic, you've lost them. You've lost them. I came across an old tweet of you, by the way. I came across an old tweet of you, which was very funny. So this was, you were listening to Paul Mills lectures, his online course. And then there was like a moment where Paul Mills, somewhere in the beginning, asks, who of you has like followed a course in logic?
Yeah,
before doing this course. And then you had posted this screenshot or this GIF of...
somebody raising their hand.
Hermione and Harry Potter, like, me. So I think, you wouldn't fall asleep. But most people just don't like logic. Oh. They were not trained in it. I mean...
Yeah.
I studied philosophy for a year. Uh-huh. And in the first year of philosophy, you just get logic.
Yeah.
Now, it's been a while, but recently for a project, we sort of refreshed it, maybe actually relevant for this context, might mention it. But so we're really talking about making logical statements.
Yeah.
If this, then that, in a very formal manner. And these are called propositions, right, that you make.
Yeah. What is the use of these propositions, Daniel?
So the use of these propositions is they are an essential component of the tests that we're going to do. So these propositions are the logical structure between our theory and certain predictions. We have not filled them in yet.
Right.
We'll do that later. We don't really know how we will measure these things. So the then, then this should happen. We don't really know what then looks like in the world yet. That doesn't matter. This is a logical statement. My theory says if this happens, we manipulate this, then this thing is supposed to happen. And this is all described, still in the language of your theoretical model. So what is the use of this? And sometimes I think more people should read Popper's The Logic of Scientific Discovery. Because I think if you read the title, you say The Logic of Scientific Discovery, I think many people think this means something like the rationale of scientific discovery or something, right? But he means the logic the logic, the logical statements, the propositional statements that we make that allow us to assign truth values to basic statements. So this is all logic.
It's the logic with a capital L.
It's the actual logic underlying scientific discovery, not the rationale of how we discover stuff.
Right.
So,
nice.
So that is what he is talking about. And I feel, to really get this, why these propositional statements are so important, you really should actually read Popper's The Logic of Scientific Discovery, because, how can we have basic statements that have a truth value? And why do they need to have a truth value? Because if they have a truth value, if this, then that, then we can also falsify them.
Yeah, exactly.
And again, Dubin already said he likes Popper. Yep. He read him. Yep. He considers this. So that's why he has to put this phase in.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There has to be a point where if we are going to go out and test things, we have to carefully specify the logic in propositional statements of the predictions our theory makes.
Yeah.
And these logical propositions have a truth statement, if this, then that. And then we can do, these modus tollens kind of things where you say,
But we didn't see that, so then not this.
Exactly. So now I have a problem.
Yeah.
And if you keep this vague, that is the problem. And this is, I mentioned, so we are, I was refreshing this and I'm supervising a PhD student, Christian Mesquita, and he is actually writing a paper on, he was very frustrated that people are quite vague about their hypotheses.
Mm-hmm.
He was coding them for a meta-scientific project, and they were just so vague. And he's like, but what is the actual logic? What are the propositional statements people should have been making in these papers? So he's going through these and saying, look, very often we see kind of mistakes here. One example maybe is multiple comparisons, for example. So people are really vague in their propositional statements when they have a couple of things they measure. So they might say, I have these students, and I think that if we give them more supervision, I think their grade might go up and they might enjoy the course a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to test this. But then you have to say, but what is your propositional statement?
Yeah.
Is it, I think, through this intervention, people will score higher on a grade?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe, and or they will like the course more.
Mm.
But if there's an or in this proposition, then you have two possible dependent outcomes. You're basically saying, I don't know, it might be this, it might, or it might be that. When does this proposition get a truth value? Well, if the one thing is significant or if the other is significant, then this combined proposition is evaluated as true.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, if either of these two dependent variables can be true, then you have to correct for multiple comparisons.
Mm.
People don't, right?
Mm-hmm.
People will also say, well, we found an effect on enjoyment, not on grades, so this supports our prediction. You're like, no, that didn't support your prediction. That would only have supported your prediction if you said, so this part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people don't think this through. And somewhere he will have a nice preprint on this, I hope.
Yeah.
And I think it will be interesting. So
nobody
will, in the worst case, nobody will read it because people don't care about logic. But
that makes me
in
so
the best
sad.
Case,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but in the best case, let's hope some reviewers of papers read it and they will just say, well, this is now exactly the kind of,
problem
in propositional logic that you have in your paper here, and you have to go and read this paper and go and fix it.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, well, looking forward to that. There's a funny clip I saw by Norm Macdonald, on talking to a professor of logic. I'll share it. It's funny.
Okay. One thing I wanted to add here.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, again, he stresses the importance of negative propositions.
Yeah.
So you don't just say, if this, then that, but you also say, if this, then not that. Right? So you predict the things that are not supposed to happen. And this is, separate from just a null hypothesis, right? We know a negative thing, like there is no difference between these things. But this is really predicting if my theory is true, then we should not find, I don't know, effects smaller than this value or something like this, you know, or effects larger than this value or whatever it is. So you're predicting things explicitly stating, if we find this, then I was wrong. That's a negative, what he means with a negative proposition.
Okay, I am struggling to understand a little bit. Because what if I say, if my theory is true, then unicorns don't exist?
If my theory is true, then unicorns do not exist. No, he's talking about propositions where you say, well, if fantasy animals don't exist, then I will not observe unicorns. Right? That's a negative statement. You're saying I will not see unicorns. I go into the forest, I count all the creatures I see, I label all of them. None of those will be unicorns, for example.
But you can, just because you don't observe any unicorns doesn't mean you can't falsify that they don't exist.
No, of course. So it's difficult in practice to falsify. And this is also what Popper discusses logical scientific discovery. Mm-hmm. Of course, it is difficult to falsify these things. So you have to come up with tests that are severe. Mm-hmm. That's why you get into all this stuff. So I agree. I mean, just looking for things. This is, I think, what is it called? The Raven problem or something? Like
the Black Swan problem?
It's the Raven's Paradox by Hempel. I know that part. I'm not prepared to explain it.
Explain it? let me see. All ravens are black in the form of lizards. If something is raven, then it is black. If something is not black, then it is not raven.
Okay, so I will briefly read out an example of this just for the reader who wants to know slightly what it's about, but this would require probably a whole hour of its own.
I don't think we could do it,
Yeah, but the issue is, I'm reading this from a website, we'll link to it. Our hypothesis, all ravens are black, therefore has the equivalent form, all non-black things are non-ravens. Or more precisely, if an object isn't black, then it is not a raven. Consequently, if every sighting of a black raven confirms our hypothesis, then every sighting of a non-black non-raven equally confirms our hypothesis. All right. We'll leave it as an exercise to the reader to figure this out. This is the Raven's Paradox.
But
what it means is both ravens and swans all point in some way to the difficulty of falsifying things. Completely agree.
Okay. All right. We can move on. Except so, I will say, it seems like a useful thing to do, to state
we're moving on. But anyway, birds tell us it is difficult to confirm the absence of things. That's definitely true. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, in propositional statements, it is very important to say, if this, not just then that, but also then not this other thing. And that's important for a solid set of propositions derived from a theory.
Yeah, good luck trying to get psychologists to both understand this and also do this. Yeah,
we did a horrible job because people were already not into logic, and now we have messed it up to a sense that I feel we have to come back to this.
We'll do an episode on logic. We want to talk about inductive and deductive reasoning, so
we might do it, or maybe we can just find experts who have a podcast on the Raven's Paradox and stuff and point them to it. But yes, all right, anyway,
okay,
logic, it's important, and study it more.
So the next one is empirical indicators of key terms.
Yes.
And this, again, as you mentioned, is measurement, right?
Basically.
This is where you start, you assign numbers to figure out how you're going to measure something, whether it's a task, it's items, it's what have you, that are going to result in some values for those units that you're interested in for the constructs.
Exactly. And this is just a bit old-fashioned way to talk about this. So it comes from this idea of operationalism.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And this is developed by a physicist, Bridgman. Mm-hmm. And he says stuff like, the empirical indicator of a unit or a theoretical model is an operation performed by an observer mm-hmm. with some kind of observing instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And the result produces a value on the unit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is operationalism. And for some reason, which I don't completely understand, this was proposed in physics and then it became super popular in psychology. I think now it is more popular in psychology than in physics. But nevertheless, yeah, it's this operationalist approach to measurement. And in psychology, we now think we have to operationalize everything, which means we have to be able to express everything into some sort of value on a unit, some sort of measurement tool. Yeah.
Well, if we're going to do quantitative work, then we sort of do, right?
I think so. I can't do
statistics on labels. Yeah.
No, yeah, completely true. I think there is also some criticism on this, whether this is actually possible in psychology, of course, yeah, and all right, these discussions. Right. But anyway,
yeah,
you know.
But measurement, we've done an episode on measurement. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, before you go on about measurement for another hour, let's just go.
Yeah.
But yeah, measurement, but still, I do want to point out that this is important. So before you go out and you measure or you theorize and you test, you need to have a good measure. He does explicitly mention in the book, your measure, of course, has to be reliable.
Right.
It has to be valid. I just want to say this is another PhD.
Yeah, yeah.
Before you can do your test.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So we already have one PhD for the concept. Well, mm-hmm. I think the boundary condition, everything else.
Mm-hmm.
We're basically at sort of three full PhD theses before we can actually go and move on to the next step. But okay, let's ignore that this is sort of inconvenient truth. Let's just jump to the next thing that we have to do.
Yes, which is the hypotheses. And those finally. Are our predictions. Yeah, finally.
Finally.
Yeah. Finally,
this is the stuff we're going to get published with.
We can wrap our hunches in nice bows and pretend we're doing something scientific. Yeah. Exactly. Well, if we've done this process, then it's a valid,
I would say so, right? If we've gone through all the effort, mm-hmm. all the steps before, then now this hypothesis is basically a logically derived prediction. With valid measurements, we know we're going to measure it in the right way. We know that we have made logical propositions. We know that we've specified realistic boundary conditions. And when we find it, we have carefully thought about our units and we have defined them. And boom, here we go.
Yeah.
Now we have a real test.
It's falsifiable. We know conditions mm-hmm. under which, like when it's going to not hold up or like what we will observe that will allow us to falsify this prediction. And also that we then that makes the numbers interpretable, right? Once we've established the units, measure them well, then you can actually, whatever result you get can tie back to the units of interest, right? You know that inference is valid back to the units and how they work together.
Yeah. And the result of the test is going to have consequences for your theory.
Right.
And I think really we're
merging number 8 as well because that's the testing part.
Okay. We skip to the test.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have our hypothesis and this hypothesis is very nicely derived.
Uh-huh.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, okay. And then
last part is testing. Yeah.
Last step, 8th step is the test.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that this hypothesis now has is that the test result is going to have consequences for our theory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the goal. The goal is that you've gone through all these efforts so that if you find it, your theory really gets a boost.
Mm-hmm.
But also if you don't find it, then your theory is actually really in trouble. And well, that second part is definitely often not true.
Yeah.
Because people have been so vague about what they mean.
Right.
They didn't say what their boundary condition was.
Right,
and they can
really,
you know.
So null results are not really informative.
They hardly impact your theory. Your theory just survives, you know.
Yeah.
It's exactly like this Paul Mill quote that we said in the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. That in the soft psychology, the theories rise and decline, come and go more as a function of baffled boredom than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the anything else? The anything else is, no, your test results really had an impact on your theory.
Right.
And if the test results don't bear out your prediction and that happens for a while, then it's gone. Then it's gone, your theory.
Right.
And that's what you want to achieve. And that is surprisingly rare.
Yeah. Well, sometimes theories get updated with new information. And if there's one thing I could add to this list is, well, I do think it gets mentioned at the end of just the iterative process, right? You're like the results of the testing should really feed into refining the theory, which is also a big part of like what we talk about in measurement, right? That your the results you get should inform your construct. And here it will be like, right, you update your theory or change your theory based on what you see. Not often. I agree.
Well, yeah. And I have to say, I slightly regretted that I said, like, how often does this happen?
Yeah.
Not often.
Yeah.
Because I really don't know. I really don't know how often this happens.
Well,
I mean, there might really be fields where there is much more theoretical tests and real building and updating. I mean, I don't know how often it happens.
I mean, I think the issue with our discipline is what you mentioned very in the very beginning, which is it's not even that people are building a program where they're following a theory, you know, over time and trying to see and actually develop a single theory. It's mostly, we have a hunch. Let's run a few studies, see if it holds. If it does, you get it published and then you move on to the next thing. And if it doesn't, then you also move on to another thing. Right.
Yeah.
And maybe some lines of research that actually pan out, you then follow along and figure out the boundary conditions. But I think for a lot of cases, it's not the investment comes after they have found some significant effect and not right. The investment is not in actually developing a theory and then seeing it through and then updating it because you're interested in some units and some relationships between them intrinsically.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You're completely right. And this is one thing that I thought about quite a bit in this whole process. So we have this whole list of things. We know that people are really rewarded for testing some hypothesis and making some sort of empirical claim. And they don't get a lot of, there are not a lot of costs of doing these tests with relatively bad measures or with relatively badly defined constructs. You can just go to this last step and do it and you reap most of the rewards.
Yeah.
And especially, right, so investing a lot of time in defining your concept or developing a very reliable measure. Again, in some fields, maybe your paper really gets rejected if the measure is not validated, but often you can just get away with it. So it's not worth doing all this stuff.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. Another thing that I was thinking about is with a test, I know pretty well when a test is a good test in the sense of like a hypothesis test, right? Statistical hypothesis test. I can see that you had a large sample size. So then you had pretty high power. Okay. And you controlled your error rate nicely. So like, you've done that part well and you've computed all the numbers correctly. And I can see this is a very well done hypothesis test. But how, and you know, and maybe you have a bunch of them, like five. Yeah, wow, you had five of these hypothesis tests. So the more, the better. Now you have a five study paper, you can go to a better journal. So it's very easy to evaluate and give credits for and score it on some sort of thing. And then say, so that has to go to this journal. Good job, you get a lot of rewards. But how does this work for conceptualizing? What is a very good conceptual analysis? And what is like, or conceptually engineered definition? And what is a mediocre one? And what is a pretty bad one?
Well, we'll know it when we see it. I don't know. I don't know.
Maybe to a certain extent. Sure. To a certain extent. But I feel, I mean, first of all, there is no journal that would just publish these steps by themselves, right? But I also feel that we don't really have a good, you know, we might develop it over time, but we don't really have a good tool set to say, oh, good done, Schmitty, your paper on definition is a really good one. But Daniel, your paper, sorry. Sorry, this is borderline publishable, man. I mean, come on. I don't know when you have one or the other. So that's another problem with wanting to reward these steps. I mean, we were joking sort of the journal of boundary conditions. Okay, so when did you do a very good job in trying to find boundary conditions? And when did you do a mediocre job? I don't know, you know?
Yeah, so Paul Meal Journal of Theory, is that upcoming? Yeah. Of theory development?
I think so. there are a couple of things I would love to see.
Yeah.
First, I would just love to see books about actual good theories, where they really explain, like, you know, a couple of really good theories. And we have them, you know. I mean, there are all sorts of theories of, I don't know, learning, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the behaviorists did a pretty right. good job in developing
reinforcement learning, right.
Reinforcement learning yeah. is, I think, an example of a theory that is one of the strongest mm-hmm. we have.
Yeah.
There are very good computational models. I just did some edits on a co-authored paper with a colleague of mine, Chao Zhang, mm-hmm. on reinforcement learning,
yeah.
formally modeling habit formation mm. processes based on reinforcement learning.
Nice.
It is really, really rigorous mm-hmm. kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
These models that exist really nicely predict data, mm-hmm. and you know, it does everything you want. So, yeah, reinforcement learning is a great example of something that is a very good theory.
Yeah.
How did it get so good? What did we do? What does it look like? And then a couple of others, you know, mm-hmm. in a couple of other domains. So I would love to see really good cases of theories described.
Right, just case studies of, right, and see.
Case studies, mm-hmm. case studies of some of the best theories in our field so that we can read them and be like, okay, so this is it. This is what it looks like. Right. Good to know.
Yeah. No, I think that would be super useful. Yeah.
Yeah. So that would be one step to improve things a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And another thing is, develop clearer guidelines
yeah.
of what we expect to be very good. Yeah, all of these steps, very good boundary condition searching and very good conceptual definitions right. of things. And I have no idea there
yeah.
where it's to start.
Hard. Yeah, I wish I could help you, but...
No, I mean, we're not going to solve that here. You know, it's too complex.
Damn it, yeah.
Yeah, damn it. Well, but hopefully we will inspire some people to work on stuff like yeah. this, you know,
mm-hmm.
and really, again, it's this quote before by Swedberg, like, there's so much progress in methods on these things and so little on theory, right? We have all these reporting guidelines, and if you look at the reporting guidelines, the journal article reporting standards
mm-hmm.
are probably like 50% about how to report methods.
You're so right. Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that. Yeah, there's barely anything about what to actually. Yeah, it's mostly just methods and how to write the figures and what to include in the how to report p-values and what participant mm-hmm. characteristics should be included, but not much about what should go in the introduction. Apart from, hey, background, yeah. you know, tell us vaguely what you think was going yeah. on. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I feel there has to be a lot of work there helping people
yeah.
like this is a very good way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're still sort of faced with the reward. Part of it, like, why would you actually do it?
Do it if it's not being yeah. valued, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah. I think there it would at least, because I mean, I'm sort of joking, like this is a PhD thesis 4 years, yeah. but I do really think that that's what it is. So I think it also means we need to diversify the content of, for example, PhD theses. Right, we shouldn't expect everybody to go through these 8 steps. If you do a PhD thesis and you went through steps 1 to 3,
mm-hmm.
great. Because if that's what's necessary in your field,
then that's it, right.
Then that's it. That's your PhD. Great. That's already awesome if you managed to do that well.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, there can be some data collection. And, you know, often we want to see people run some tests so we know they can do it. But I'm sure you can get that done in the boundary condition part or yeah. somewhere, you know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or maybe this is a, well, yeah. Yeah. Doesn't mean it has to be done. Well, actually, no, it probably does have to. It'd probably be good to start with this. I was going to say you could do it after your PhD, but no. If you're going to mm-hmm. do it right, it makes sense to do it from the beginning, right? And then it's just going to be a slow process of first learning to do this and then only then moving on to,
yeah.
to actually testing.
I mean, it's this whole interactive process anyway, of course. That's mm-hmm. true. But I would really love to have more. Yeah, also collaboration. I think for the conceptual definition part would be very good to have more collaboration with
philosophers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I mean, we were starting this project with my colleague and we were saying, yeah, so how do you really do this? Can you explain, like, what is the method?
Yeah.
And he's like, well, you know, you just go sit in your chair and you just do stuff.
Smoke a pipe.
That's like philosophy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But then he became a bit more serious. He's like, no. Yeah, it's like, you know, conceptual engineering is a term. And I wonder why didn't I ever hear about
conceptual
this thing?
Conceptual engineering,
you know?
I mean, yeah. That sounds and a maybe bit like it is social a bit more engineering. Recent. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, and I said it's more popular recently, mm-hmm. but it's a very old idea that goes all the way back to Carnap in the 50s, 1950s.
Interesting. Okay.
He calls it the explication of concepts. So okay. So he wrote about this as an important part, you know? I mean, so anyway, nothing of this is new, but maybe it's a bit more popular nowadays for some reasons, mm-hmm. but yeah. So more a bit more interdisciplinary work to get all these different steps done would probably also be good.
Would also be great. And last question, Daniel. If you had to pick, which of these 8 steps do you think is the most difficult?
Yeah. It's a nice question. I think the boundary condition step. I think it's just the most difficult. It sounds very easy to find some. But in this step, I also wonder, there's so many dimensions you can go and explore boundary conditions mm-hmm. on and which are relevant, which mm-hmm. are interesting. Mm-hmm. I think it's a ton of work to find them, you know, because it's not just one test, you know, finding this one thing. Okay, you do your hypothesis test, mm-hmm. but now you have to do a ton of tests. You know, it will be a mess. You have to collect a lot of data across all of these dimensions. Mm-hmm. I think these boundary conditions are a ton of work to do well.
Yeah.
And by the way, I mean, this is also why, which is maybe a topic we want to talk about another time, but this idea of multiverse analysis, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, and this flexibility in data analysis. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like, well, it works if you do it like this, but not if you do it like this, or, you know, okay. If you are serious about this, then these are boundary conditions,
right.
All of them. Mm-hmm. And if there are a ton of them, like how are we going to examine all of them? It's going to be so much work. Mm-hmm. So I really feel like, okay, this is minefield that mm-hmm. we want to carefully think about. If you do it well, I don't know. How do we do this? Mm-hmm. It's a ton of work. So that would be my first mm-hmm. guess. I don't know. What did you think, like reading through this? What do you think is a tricky one? You want to go with your measurement, say that's the most important.
Yeah, I mean, and I but I will actually
No, fair enough. Fair
no,
enough,
no, but
fair
I will actually enough. Put that on the first one, the units part, because I think because I do think that this whole cycle that we're talking about, I think you actually have to start with it in just the unit section, right? First, go through that whole process of what's my theory for this construct, right? How am I going to measure it? What are going to be my indicators? Then do the measurement, then refine it, right? So I think this whole process is first repeated in just the part about units. So I think it's difficult just in terms of how to do it well, like how much time and effort it takes. Right. Not that we don't know how to do it. It's like, no, we know a little bit about how to do it. It just takes a lot of effort and a lot of time to do it well. I think it's difficult in that sense. Yeah.
I know. I mean, and that's just like, so you just read through all these steps.
Yeah.
And then you're just like, wait, so we said barely anything about this hypothesis generation and testing step, because that's really the easiest part of all this. This is the least amount of work. Yeah. And all and the other stuff is like a ton of more work.
Right. We just jumped to that. Yeah.
Okay. So, and then thinking, okay, so now let's take that seriously and do it well.
We should do it. And
we made science a lot more difficult for everybody.
But that's our job. That's what we do. I do want to end with reading a section of this quote that we've read before. So this is bequest of Pavlov to the academic youth of his country. And there's a section of it which I think is very relevant here to this discussion. So I want to end with that, where he says, "Perfect as is the wing of a bird, it never could raise the bird up without resting on air. Facts are the air of a scientist. Without them, you can never fly. Without them, your theories are vain efforts. But learning, experimenting, observing, try not to stay on the surface of the facts. Do not become the archivists of facts. Try to penetrate to the secret of their occurrence. Persistently search for the laws which govern them." And I think this part is so great, because he talks about, yes, like it's really like you first need to sort of get your hands dirty and just get collect facts, right? That is important, right? So when we talk about just doing empirical stuff well, right, the methods and being rigorous in how you're doing things, that is super important. But I think you also, right, you don't want to just be a collector of facts. You actually want to try to delve deeper and understand what's going on. And I think that is really
build your theory.
Build your theory, exactly, from solid facts.
Good advice.
Yeah.
Very good advice.
Yeah. Don't experiment on dogs, though.
Okay. Sure. Pretty random ending, but let's do it. You know, I'm there for it. I think it's good.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Nullius in Verba. Our theme song is Newton's Cradle by Grand Brothers. If you have any thoughts, feedback, or comments you'd like to share, you can reach us over email at nulliusinverbapod@gmail.com or our social media accounts at Mastodon or Twitter.
In this episode, we finished our discussion of how to build better theories in psychology and criticized the lack of discussion and training on this topic. In the next episode, we will discuss the role of criticism in science. We hope you will join us.